Welcome, everybody, to the Media Roundtable Industry Edition. If you're keeping up with us, you know that sometimes we talk to leading voices in the podcast community about what they create and why and all kinds of impact that they like to have. But while we're in this industry edition, we're getting a little bit more into the weeds. We're getting a little wonky here, and we're focusing on how do you make impact through the ads that you run. And of course, one of the biggest challenges that the industry faces is knowing how to measure things. And there's a lot of confusion about what it is we're even measuring. Are we measuring how many people listen to a show or a station? Are we measuring what the response is to the ads? Today, we're going to spend some time talking about how people respond to the ads. This is part two to our attribution conversation. I am still your host, Dan Granger. I'm the CEO and founder of Oxford Road. And this is a fun topic, and we have April Fools right around the corner. So we thought we'd cover something that's just hilarious to everybody, which is how do you count the response levels that you see when you run an ad in an audio channel? So we did part one of this a few weeks back, and we had the legendary Alan Jones, who is CEO of Bambi, former CMO of ZipRecruiter, and he was talking from his perspective as an advertiser. Today, I am joined again by two of our partners at Oxford Road that have been working with me for many, many years. We have Giles Martin. Welcome, Giles.
Thank you, Dan.
And Giles is our head of data and insights. And then we also have Kyle Jelinek, who's really been with us since the beginning in 2013. Welcome back, Kyle. Glad to have you here. And, you know, I think that we want to prioritize hearing from brands who are faced with this problem to run their business. And I think that sometimes that's the best information you can have. But this is, we're keeping this conversation internal right now because working at Oxford Road, you know, our lives depend on attribution. Our campaigns depend on attribution, whether or not the advertisers that we partner with can believe the information that they're seeing about the response is really how they decide if they're going to continue to work for us. So when you work at an agency that specializes in this field and has to show their impact on a daily basis to the marketplace, this is everything. And you have the opportunity not just to work across one brand, but, you know, Kyle has probably worked with 50 to 100 different accounts during his tenure here. I would argue that the two gentlemen I have with me today have probably worked across solving this problem across more brands and more dollars in this industry, at least as much as anybody else, maybe more than anybody else in our field. So I'm really glad you guys are able to come back to participate in the second leg of this conversation. Welcome.
Happy to be here. This is our life.
Yeah, and if you're watching the video, which most of you probably are not, Kyle has like five guitars behind him, and he does know how to play them. We're hoping that at some point, as a bonus, Kyle might actually record a new theme song for this show because everybody hates our music. I've never met anybody that liked it. I was trying to go for something really patriotic along some of the themes that have inspired this show. But I don't think that that's really caught on. So we're looking for something special, and we're hoping as a byproduct, not only are you going to understand how to measure your campaigns more effectively when you advertise in audio, but you're also going to be able to look forward to the tunes that Kyle puts together that we can score the show with. So that's good. And then, of course, I was trying to convince Giles to join this podcast for more than a year, and we finally got him to join. So this is a special group. This is a special group that we have today. Guys, let's just talk really quick. Any big takeaways that stood out for you in our last conversation with Alan when he came on and gave his perspective as it relates to attribution?
I mean, I definitely do. I thought it was super interesting to hear him say when he was talking with his internal teams about wanting to test radio for the first time, saying, well, you know, if it doesn't fit in with your current way of measuring things, are you going to use that as a reason not to do this? Or are we going to figure out a way to measure this so we can extract the growth here? And it was just, interesting that people, you know, often come from, you know, what they know, what they're comfortable with, and the default mindset is, you know, oh, we can't measure that. And it's great that there are marketers like Alan out there who are willing to push and, you know, open doors and open people's minds and say, can we please be practical about driving some growth here? And if we need to figure out a new way to measure this, then let's do it. Like, it's interesting that it's a sort of creative exercise as well as an analytical and a mathematical one in that respect.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when the agency first started and Alan was putting together this survey, and we worked with Alan to create what we call our survey methodology here with his launching of ZipRecruiter into the audio space. And what we're doing now with him is just kind of adding on to that. But he's always been a pioneer, always been looking for ways to improve and measure what we're doing here, and an invaluable voice here in the space. And was really lucky to get him on the show last time.
Cool. So this is a topic that it feels like it's always been with us. And in some ways, everything has changed, especially with pixels and things feeling a little bit more digital. But also nothing has changed, because as soon as people are adding pixels, they're all of a sudden having to back away from them, right? So it's it may not have come as far as we all hoped it would in our industry, but maybe that isn't necessary. Let me ask you guys this question. Do you feel like the problem of attribution ever really gets solved?
No.
Only in one area, which is like pure direct response media. So if you're talking about dialing a specific 800 number for a specific network, radio show, TV channel, whatever it might be, it is pretty easy to count the number of calls you get to that specific number within a certain time window. And similarly with direct mail, those types of things really are quite trackable, and it is possible to eliminate a lot of the ambiguity that exists in the rest of the ecosystem. So that's my shout out to traditional hardcore response media.
Well, and I think that so much of what we do, particularly in podcast, which takes up about 80% of the oxygen in the audio conversation, right? Yeah. We shy away from the term direct response, because I think what we know is direct response is actually impossible, because you don't even necessarily know when somebody's going to consume the impression. And therefore, traditional models of, hey, we're going to look at response rates within 30 seconds of when an ad fell, those fall apart very quickly. We talked about the challenge with time sequencing as your model. But I think to just kind of validate your point, Giles, if you can have a business or have a business that allows you to funnel all traffic through one channel and you can advertise that channel so that you can see the direct signal, I think that works. But certainly 99% or more of the conversations that I'm involved in, that's really not on the table for anybody, right? So I think that, look, the which half works, the alleged Wanamaker quote, it's 100 years old, we're still struggling with this. And I think there's, I think what we're trying to do is get to a state of good enough in attribution, because we know that you're never going to figure out, why did you make the decision about what you were going to have for lunch today, right? There's a lot of different factors that could go back to before you were born for why you're having what you're having. You're never going to be able to have that one silver bullet reason, but we want to try to get to something that's useful and acceptable so you can feel confident in the decisions that you make. But it's interesting, like Giles, when you talk about direct response television or radio or direct mail, why do you think that audio is a little bit extra challenging compared to some of the other methods that might work in other channels? Why is it so much harder for us, do you think?
Well, I think one reason, you know, that we've talked about going back to the days of radio, a lot of audio consumption is in the car during drive times, and it makes it difficult for people to respond to an ad at that time, or to remember what they were told, or even remember the brand, or to write anything down. So that presents an obstacle in audio consumption there. And when you think about more digital channels, you know, one of the main use cases for podcasting and also for streaming is putting the audio on while you're busy doing other things, whether that's working out or cleaning the house or, you know, working on the computer. It could be anything. And so there are these distractions around that may not be, you know, quite the same in other channels.
And I would also say, even when we were talking like MMMs, podcasts in particular are challenging to feed the MMMs because the way the media is consumed is it changes. So, you can apply some distributions of listenership on a podcast that drops, but how do you actually tie that back into spend into the MMM can be a challenge as well.
Yeah. And just to kind of tie back what you guys are both saying, a lot of this comes down to what people are doing when they consume it, right? Not everybody's driving when they listen to a podcast, but there's a reason that they're not streaming Netflix or, you know, watching a TV show, right? There are specific types of media that we consume on a couch, in a bed, in a chair, where we are doing nothing, but we have our phone in our hand, and we are prepared to take an action. If you get a piece of direct mail, you're holding a piece of paper in your hand with instructions on paper in front of you. You hear audio because your legs and hands are probably doing something else. Your eyes are doing other things too. And so to get somebody to take an action at the point in which the ad is served, very, very challenging. And so we have to come up with all these other proxies to help us give a picture to what the actual response is without the ability to map it back in real ways. So it's going to be with us for a while, but what we're going to do right now is somewhat clinical, but wildly important and really the backbone of any successful audio campaign. We're going to talk about some of the best practices for how different companies use different methods of attribution in audio. So Giles, give us a just simple description of the tried and true method that most brands have used for audio historically.
Well, at its simplest, it's using that "How did you hear about us?" survey at checkout. And you will look at the percentage of people that are saying, "I heard about you on radio or on podcast," and you're applying that percentage to your sales or your leads or whatever it is your KPI is. Now, there is obviously this show level granularity that we want to get to, media property level. And that's where we will drive people to vanity URLs or encourage them to use promo codes, which allows us to track at the individual property level as well. And it's really a combination of those two factors.
So just to say it back to you a different way and underscore this, the backstop that the industry has historically relied on is that you ask people, "How'd you hear about us?" You give them a survey. It's probably, hopefully, somewhere in the funnel for their response if there's an online activity. And that tells you what type of media it came from. And then you ask for, and that kind of gives you a denominator to show you channel response. And then to get precise response so you can optimize campaigns, you need a signal. And that signal is going to oftentimes come from a promo code, a vanity URL, and to in the spirit of a theme we're talking about a lot lately, you can now use a second layer survey with predictive text. And what that allows you to do is know how show A performed against show B, against show C, and extrapolate using the percentage of your total response, that denominator again, you can see how much of the channel's contribution that individual show really delivered. Now, that's been the old standby for the industry. Why do we need anything else? What are the limitations of this as you guys see it?
The greatest challenge with the survey is what that multiplier is, what we generate from that survey. So what I see is the multiplier that's generated is basically for every one vanity URL or promo code, on average, will represent 3 to 10 more conversions that were drawn from that channel.
Yep.
Sometimes when you have a client that literally has maybe a long purchase cycle or a long time to the intent to actually purchase, if it's a higher cost, or and if they have no offer, the chances of somebody actually using that vanity URL becomes much, much lower. I have clients I work with that, you know, 60, 100. So for every one direct, you get 60 others that are saying it in the survey. Yes, I heard from you on podcast, but they didn't use the vanity URL. And as a result of that, if you have a very small podcast and you apply a multiplier, one direct order can make all the difference. And so getting a more granular view of which podcast in that survey is paramount, and it'll help kind of help us optimize the campaigns accordingly.
Giles, any other challenges you see with the traditional model?
No, I really think that that's the biggest one. It really affects some of our B2B clients with that low volume that comes in. You know, with promo codes, obviously you have the issue of leakage on sites like RetailMeNot and other coupon sites. Vanities do get leaked as well, of course, but it tends to have affected promo codes more historically.
That's easier. Yeah.
And we encourage clients to use a vanity rather than a promo code for that reason. But no, I think those are the main concerns.
So I'm going to say it back in a different way, just so that less acquainted listeners can make sure they're tracking. So, you know, a lot of what Kyle is talking about is when we talk about a multiplier, that's the ratio between that numerator and the denominator. The denominator is the where'd you hear about us, the channel level. The signal you get is the numerator, which oftentimes is a vanity URL or a promo code. We like the second layer survey because we think it gives you a lot more precision. But the big problem there is that sometimes you're extrapolating and saying, okay, I see that I got 100 signups from podcast, but all my vanity URL codes only show me like five conversions through that. And then you go, okay, well, so every one of those conversions actually equals 20. And that's not a big enough sample size to draw statistically significant conclusions. Sample size is really, really important. And whatever you're going to be doing, you're probably dealing with samples. And so the larger your sample, the more confidence you're going to have in that sample. So that's where a lot of this falls short. A couple other things I would probably flag is that if your brand is sold at retail, you don't have e-commerce involved, it adds an additional layer of complexity. You can't give everybody that buys a six-pack of Coke a survey that says, how'd you hear about us? And they're not going to do that at the grocery store. So there are additional types of products that it becomes really challenging for. And then I think one of the other things, and I think Alan meant, we talked about this with Alan when he was on, was that sometimes we just don't think it's sophisticated enough because it's kind of simple. It doesn't require a lot of real tech. And when you go, oh, pixels, future, look at this new model, it seems so basic that I think a lot of people just rule it out because they go, it's not fancy enough for us,
it's a really interesting point. I think because a lot of our clients and prospects are digital natives. They're used to clever sounding attribution methods. And I think a lot of them are turned off by something that is so simple, but as you know, I think more and more people are coming to appreciate simplicity actually is not a bad thing at all. It's increasingly, I think, viewed as a wonderful thing. And, you know, a lot of these methodologies, like Kyle was talking about MMMs earlier, and when clients sit in front of a, you know, analytics agency listening to their MMM readout, I think that they perhaps interpret that as being very, very precise and very, very reliable in terms of the estimates they're getting. And the truth is, no, that's an estimate with a fairly large range of confidence typically, but they don't typically talk to you about what that range of confidence is and what that might mean for the results of the analysis. So I think a lot of these channels pretend to have a degree of precision that they don't, or suggest that they do, and they really don't. And I think a survey in that respect is really no different from any other approach. And hopefully some of that could put some of our clients' concerns to rest. And there's more I could say about that. And maybe this is the forum. I don't know. But
well, you know what? Here's where I want to dig in with you is, so I think we just gave a nice overview of survey-based attribution and the importance of, if you're able to use it, if you don't have a product that's sold at retail or there's some special reason why it's not going to work for you, don't be turned off by its simplicity. I think that's a big takeaway. But you brought up a second method, and I want to go through some of the top ones. And you brought up the MMM model. Can you, in a nutshell now, go and explain what is MMM, and then we can unpack it a little bit and talk about if and when it makes sense?
Yeah, it's really, essentially, it's very simple in its core. It is looking at something that you want to predict, like sales, and something that you think is going to have an impact on sales, like advertising. So if you have a big increase in spend the week of March the 20th in radio, and you have a big increase in sales the week of March the 20th, the model is going to say, oh, look, there was a big increase in sales and you spent up in radio that week. And it's going to say, well, maybe there's a relationship there. Now, obviously, that's a very, very simple way of representing it. And it works over many weeks or days where there's large time periods to absorb. So you're looking at lots of spikes in sales with lots of variation in spend in radio and other media channels too. But essentially, it's just looking for those relationships where if spend goes up in a certain channel, do sales go up? If spend goes down, do sales go down? And it's drawing conclusions from that.
And when people talk about econometric modeling, how does that compare or how does that enter into the MMM method?
I mean, I think technically, like, econometrics is a branch of economics, and even I'm not like fully qualified to speak about that. But I mean, essentially, I think to all intents and purposes, for marketing's use cases, you can consider them the same thing.
Okay. And so the way I think about MMM, and I'm going to poke a couple holes in it and then leave it to you guys to add any other challenges for why a marketer may not want to go down that path. I think about MMM as, look, you don't have the opportunity because of the nature of your brand to do show by show performance by performance. You don't have a strong signal that every sale is going to send up. And therefore, you need to get estimates. And we're doing high volume as a large brand. MMM is a good way to get a decent estimate on how your channel mix is going. And it may help you make decisions about how to allocate budgets between channels. Mm-hmm. However, the challenges I've always had with when people start talking media mix modeling for audio is two. Number one, it gives you no granular detail to help you optimize inside of a campaign. You might say, oh, we want to push 10% of our budget from digital to upper funnel with demand gen like TV and radio, but it's not going to tell you that this show performed better than that show, which when you're trying to optimize a campaign, it doesn't do you a whole lot of good. My second challenge with MMM is that my understanding of the process of creating it is it's all about feeding in post logs and what time insertions occurred. And as we just talked about, some of those channels that you feed into that model gave somebody an impression at a very precise time so that they can take an action at that moment and they can look for that correlation. But in audio, you have this time gap, which makes it a little bit harder to ladder back to which campaign created that impact. Giles,
MMMs are time-based, but they typically would not look at spot log details. That's too granular for an MMM. They would look at daily or weekly spend or impressions, typically by media channel. So you would aggregate up all of those flat log data across a day or a week.
But one of the challenges that happened with that, let's say I buy a podcast. It's a massive podcast. It's baked in. We spent $50,000 on it. It drops on Friday. So the spend reported will be in that week. But frankly, the majority of the consumption of that particular podcast will take place in the subsequent weeks. Yep. And therefore the MMM is not going to pick up on that. So you're going to say, we spent an extra 50,000 and it didn't pick that.
So the example I gave where, you know, you spend up in 1 week and sales go up in 1 week, that's to illustrate like the most basic sort of principle of like of how they work. If you spend a lot of money on an MMM, your analytics team working on your behalf will be building assumptions about lag effects into their model and testing those assumptions as they go. So the fact that money is spent in a given week doesn't mean that they can't make some estimate of what might happen in the second week and the third week as a result of that spend. It can get a bit speculative, but it's not impossible.
All right, so tell me if you've ever heard of any of these companies. Indeed, Shopify, NetSuite, Headspace, Quip, Theragun, Postmates. You know, I'm not only the host of the Media Roundtable, but also CEO of a company called Oxford Road, and we are the world's leading independently owned and operated audio ad agency. And what that means is that we help great companies, many that you have probably heard of on some of the other podcasts that you listen to. We help them test and scale campaigns in audio channels, with podcast being one of those leading channels. Some of the work that we do includes media planning and buying, as well as analytics, attribution, and insights. And we also have a very special way that we deal with creative and copy generation. We have our own proprietary process called Audiolytics that allows us to score ads for their persuasiveness. If you're looking to be involved in audio and you want a partner that can help work with you to make sure that you achieve unprecedented ROI and massive scale, you should get in touch with us at Oxford Road. And by the way, the only reason that we're able to do the work of the Media Roundtable is because we have a great team at Oxford Road that supports us and makes it possible. So, you know, what we're doing is not just a podcast, but we're really trying to help brands live out their values and balance that with their business objectives, which is an increasingly hard thing to do in this world of misinformation and malice that's infecting so much of our media. But at Oxford Road, we don't want to just broker this stuff. We want to impact the industry for good. We want to raise the bar on what gets created. And Oxford Road is helping make that possible through the Media Roundtable. So if you're somebody that's interested in working with an ad agency or a partner on this type of work for your advertising campaigns, go to oxfordroad.com. It's easy to spell. And get in touch with us, or at least just sign up for our free newsletter, The Influencer. That's oxfordroad.com. So underscoring back to you what the takeaway for a marketer is on when they're thinking about MMM, it could be an interesting way if you have serious budget, like you're spending at least tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in marketing cumulatively, and you want to figure out how to have the best balance of budget allocation between channels, this might be a nice way to go. However, for the performance marketer that's trying to make show level decisions, network level decisions, it's really not going to help you out. You guys agree with that summary?
Yep.
Okay. I want to talk about time series analysis a little bit more. I know we've been poo-pooing it a lot, and we should. Can either of you talk about the? I don't want to name any names here because there's good people that are working on this and working really hard to try to make it work. But as long as I've been in this industry, what I've experienced is a new company comes out and says, we do attribution for audio in a new way. And that new way looks at post logs and looks at response times, the old way, right? The way that works on TV, right? And we try to apply it. Why does this keep happening? And why do we have to keep having this conversation? I guess that's my question.
I think it's because a lot of the people that go into the audio space, they come from a digital background in many ways. I don't want to say they've been spoiled, but they're used to the granular data that you can get from a digital campaign.
Okay.
And you want to find, and you're desperately seeking out whatever kind of solution that will get you what you become used to and expect. And when you can't get that, it's like, let's grasp at straws and try to find ways to connect those dots. And this is one that keeps returning for whatever reason, because it has become, I think, the staple of television. People say, oh, it'll definitely work for radio, radio and television. That's the old guard. We can do it with this. We got a solution. And it just doesn't work because they're fundamentally different.
Well, and it's interesting because there's always somebody pushing the new program. And I've even seen pixel-based companies trying to get in the same game. But I think they all intend to do well, and I think they mean to do well. And it looks and feels digital-esque. But at the end of the day, I think we know it can give you a lot of false precision, and that can be really catastrophic for campaigns. So, you know, beware. There's a lot of different permutations. But we've yet to see one that beats some of the other methods that we've been talking about and that we're about to talk about. Giles, any other final comments?
I just wanted to go on record as saying that I am not a huge believer in that methodology for TV either.
Oh, really? For direct response television, you also?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I imagine they're closer to the whole just because they have a captive audience who's stationary, right? But yeah, I hear you. And they all have their challenges, but certainly with audio, like, kind of a non-starter for me.
Yeah, a fun game to play when you get a TV campaign and look at the results is just to rank order the response by spend on each channel, and you'll often find that there's a major correlation there. This is what I've seen with these kind of time-based analysis of television. So
interesting. Well, what happens if you put fake spots into a model to see if say more about the can you give us a blind case study here on that?
Blind case study is we had somebody who cracked audio attribution, quote unquote. We've got the way and we did it. And it looked good. It looked in line with what we'd seen. But over time, pulling levers and seeing stuff, we didn't see the results that we would expect from the levers that we were pulling. So we came up with a way to validate the response that we were getting with this company by putting into the spot log file that we sent fake networks with fake spot logs and spend. And seeing how those spots that we know, in fact, didn't run, but the model didn't know that they didn't run. And our feedback, and Giles, I think I'll quote you, was the fake spots are working, buy more. Because it was ridiculous. There was no correlation, no difference on these spots from what we saw with the others. So it killed it. Yeah.
Yeah. So the moral of that story is if you find yourself in the middle of a time series analysis platform where you're running a campaign and looking at the correlation between time that spot dropped and impact in traffic, put in a few fake ones and see if there's a projected response from a phantom unit. And that's a good way to find out if there's, you know, legitimacy behind the spot. It's a good, simple method. Okay. Let's talk about the big one, right? Which is like we work in an industry that's trying to retrofit itself to become digital. Radio is becoming streaming, and podcast has always been sort of offline considered, and now it's trying to shift over to become more digital. And there are a lot of digital capabilities that are usable for many podcasts now, but one of those is being able to use pixels. So Giles, can you just set the table for us on where the industry is in that development and the kind of pros and cons of relying on this in the state that the industry is in today? Because if I'm a marketer, I think, well, look, can I do this like I do everything digital? Digital is smarter, therefore we use the digital solution. How does it really work?
I think where the industry is still catching up to the other digital channels, which makes sense. I mean, pixels have only really been used widely in podcasts maybe since 2020, 2019. And there's much less data available in the podcast ecosystem than there is in the rest of the digital ecosystem. So, you know, you have a user agent, you have an IP address, those are typically the main identifiers that most of your attribution models are going to work off. And so it is more limited than the rest of the digital ecosystem. But I mean, listen, it is good for the industry that it's evolved in this way and that it's brought this tech inevitably, you know, into podcast ecosystem. And I do think it's good for advertisers to use this technology for sure.
And in March of 2023, what percentage of the podcast universe that people would sponsor is capable of executing with a pixel?
I think Kyle's better suited to answering that right now, probably.
Yeah, it's becoming more and more every day. I mean, a year ago, when if you asked me that question, it would have been under 50%. I would venture to say it's probably closer to 75% at this point. Mm-hmm.
And so if we know that it's cleaner, it's better, you don't have to work so hard to get to the information, what are the challenges? Why isn't this the new default?
Is it cleaner, Kyle?
No, it's the best and worst thing that's happened to our industry. Like
it's like democracy. It's the best solution except
for all the others. Well, yeah. Except that I don't know that that's true, though, because... you know, I think we're still hanging on to these surveys as a reliable backstop, right? Because it's so turbulent when we run these campaigns with pixels. And I think we all want to package it up and show the market that this problem is solved. Like everybody wants to do that. But then you get into the thick of it and you start asking questions and poking holes and there's challenges, right? So yeah, Kyle, please continue.
Yeah, I mean... Well, one of the major ones is the fact that, again, the 25% of podcasts that don't subscribe to being able to be pixel tracked. So what do you do with them? I mean, there's some really, really good ones that should be a part of this media plan, but you can't track it with the pixel. What do? We have a solution here at Oxford Road. I won't talk about the name of it, but they call it the Jelinek method because
they do call it that.
I was posed with the challenge of I had a client who wanted to be on both pixel track shows and non-pixel track shows. And I wanted to be able to take what we're learning from the pixel track shows and apply that to the non-pixel track shows. And that's what we do with that method. I'll spare you the details, but so that's one challenge because some clients become so used to the granular data that they could get from podcasts. They stay away from things that can't be pixel tracked.
I'm going to interrupt you before you keep moving. And I'm just going to tell you, because it took me like 6 months to understand what the Jelinek method was.
Oh, sorry.
And then I had a light bulb a couple of weeks ago. But it's the same kind of thing where you have a signal and then you have a total response. And I think that your signal, you get you get a multiplier if you can apply a direct signal. You can look at the ratio between volume of response from the show, whether that's a vanity or a promo or whatever, and you can look at the total response and look for that ratio. Well, you can do the same thing by saying, well, if the multiplier on the signal is a 7, then you can know that your denominator comes from the pixel. But the signal, it's basically like A over B equals X over Y. And you solve for X, right?
It's great that we're covering algebra in the round table. Yeah,
this is terrible. Forget it. All right. Nobody's ever going to understand. If you want to understand the Jelinek method, call Oxford Road. We'll get you a meeting with Kyle. I think that's the offer we can put out.
No, but you got it at its core. I mean, really what we're trying to do is take the signal that we're getting from the pixel tracked shows and applying it to the non-pixel tracked shows to get a fair proxy of how that's working.
Exactly. Okay. So going back to the challenges. So one of them is the whole universe can't do it. So do you want to exclude really good properties that are not capable?
Yeah.
What else?
That's one. So then the other one is, I mean, the pixel tracking is great again, but I think it's deceptively simple and deceptively accurate, right? So they're making assumptions just like the survey is making assumptions. Depending on which pixel partner that you're with, they're making assumptions based on different things. So that one attribution that they're saying, or you know, that one conversion that the pixel partner is saying is derived from a series of assumptions that those companies are making as well. So it's not as one-to-one as everybody would like to think. So that's,
they're using samples to
100%
generate conclusions. So even if you think you're getting away from samples, you're still not getting away from samples. And if those samples are small, then it may not be as reliable as we may want to believe.
Correct.
Okay. Giles, what about you? What do you see as the challenges? Why should everybody not just default to pixels?
Well, I'm not saying that pixels wouldn't be necessarily your default choice, but I would always advocate for having another backup method if that was your priority method, if not, you know, more than one. I mean, I think we're trying to get at the truth here, and it's very difficult to get at. And I think, you know, you need to have backups. I mean, I think that we often overlook that, you know, these attribution solutions, these pixel-based ones, you know, they're relying on computer code, and computer code is buggy and it has its flaws in it. And we hear a lot about programs having to be debugged and those types of things, but we don't often hear about, you know, pixel or attribution solutions being debugged. But the truth is they often are being debugged, and they often need to be debugged, sometimes for reasons that they don't find internally, sometimes for reasons that we find, or more likely Kyle finds. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we like to think that there's some nice, straight, simple matching process where some data is found about a user who listens to a show, or rather who downloads a show, and then some matching data is found when that user takes an action on one of our clients' websites, and you just match them together, and hey presto, this person was driven by the show. But actually, there's a whole bunch of middlemen in between that's connected by this code base. And there are errors that happen in there, and there are a lot of assumptions that happen in there. And often it's a bit of a black box as well. Like, we don't necessarily always have clarity about all the assumptions and all the steps in the process that actually happen in that chain.
Well, and now that the whole industry figured out how to upload podcasts to YouTube, that presents additional challenges, doesn't it? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, you can't get a traditional audio pixel in that environment. You're working within Google's, you know, walled garden there. So you're serving a whole load of impressions that are just going to fall outside of your trackable universe.
Indeed. Okay, so we're running out of time, and I think we've done some good work for those that have the patience to listen through it, to kind of contrast the leading ways to approach attribution. There are more we could discuss. There's only a couple that I'll try to bring up now. The last one is baseline lift analysis. So Giles, can you define that and talk about pros and cons there?
I mean, the way I understand that, you're essentially talking about understanding a pattern of sales going into a test or a period of advertising, and then looking for some type of movement in sales once the advertising goes live. And it is a feasible thing to do, but I mean, one of the probably the most important thing is having your budget set right in order to be able to get a proper read on that. And that depends on how big a company you are and what type of thing you're selling and how much historical data we have and how much noise and seasonality there is in that data in the pre-period. Because if you're, you know, a typical client that perhaps comes to Oxford Road and you want to spend, I don't know, a couple of $100,000 on a podcast test or a streaming test, you may not be able to measure some uplift against your baseline based off that type of investment. And so you do have to be very careful about approaching that type of test, making sure you're setting it up right.
So Giles, what I would add to the challenge with a baseline lift analysis is that I'm going to use a simple model, which is to say, all right, I'm a business. I spend $1 million a week on advertising across the board. And I know that $1 million in advertising gets me 10,000 new customers every week. So now I'm going to look for a lift over my baseline with my new audio campaign. So I'm going to spend $500,000 a week on audio, and I'm going to look and see, did I get a half and did I get a 50% lift in sales of new sales over my baseline? The problem is that that is so expensive, whatever level you're at, to move the water level up in a statistically significant way, because it's, you know, it's volatile always. And so to see a real lift that you can trust is so expensive that it precludes you from being able to spend enough money on the test. And so what happens is people say, well, we're going to spend this, we're going to look for a lift, and they need to see a 12% lift to actually make it significant, but they're only going to spend enough so that if the campaign works, they're going to see a 1% lift, and it all comes across as noise. So most people are unwilling to absorb the risk it would take to make a strong enough signal. And there's all kinds of opportunities for operator error. And then you go, okay, well, let's take a market or a couple of markets. Let's do a lift in those market, baseline lift analysis in those markets. But now you're saying, okay, can you buy enough podcasts in that market? Is there enough critical mass there when these really aren't geo-targeted assets? Typically, the marketplace is getting there, but we're not there yet. Or you buy radio, but because you're buying it locally, you're absorbing some inefficiencies that you wouldn't buy against if you bought it nationally. And so now you're paying a premium and you have to spend three times as much on your test just to see that lift and go, well, it didn't even pencil from an ROI standpoint. I threw all this money at something that may come back inconclusive. And the problem with all of these methods is that you put a lot of time and energy in, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, and money. And then if it comes back inconclusive, it's a terrible, terrible experience and adds a lot of unnecessary scrutiny. And now you've got the problem of justifying the money you just wasted, in addition to the problem of the fact that you still don't know anything. So baseline lift would be the best if you could spend enough and model it right. But this must be done with maximum care and maximum expertise. That would be my advice to a marketer. So in conclusion, we've talked a lot about different ways to measure audio campaigns. I think what we've established is that the leading ones, which we've described here, all have a lot of promise and benefits, but really only a few of them are what I think should be part and parcel of most campaigns. So barring unusual circumstances, we like pixels. We think you should engage with them, but they need to be handled with care. And it's good to have redundant methods. We believe in a reliable survey-based methodology, which is hard to execute well. But you know, we have best practices on that. And even if you're not an Oxford Road client, you can look at our resources that we continue to create to try to guide you through some of these things. But at the end of the day, sample size is important. The signals that you're making decisions on are important. And you want the largest attributable signal you can get so you can have more confidence in the conclusions that you're drawing from them. Any final thoughts from you guys while we're on this subject?
I would just say it's really important to have a partner that you can trust with it. You know, having been quite deep, for example, on the side of MMMs and you know, working to provide solutions like that for clients, I think it strikes me that a lot of clients don't really understand how they work, and therefore they don't really understand the limitations of them and the, you know, potential risks, and therefore how they can really extract the most benefit by really understanding, what is this really telling me? Like, what can I really be certain about? And I think that there's a degree of truth to that about pixels and about every methodology as well. So my invitation to all of our clients is work closely with us. Let's all get into the details as much as we can, be as transparent as possible about the benefits and the potential pitfalls of all these different methodologies, and really try and understand them as best you can.
I always say this on onboarding calls or anybody when we talk about attributions: if anybody comes and approaches you and says, we've solved attribution for audio or anything for that matter, run for the hills. Like, basically, nobody's done it. And I don't, like we talked in the beginning, might not ever happen. But what we can do is get an educated guess with as many signals as possible to get convergence in the data. And that's all we're looking for here.
Amen. All right. Well, this has been a great conversation. If you work in this space every day, if you don't, you turned it off a long time ago. So thanks for tuning in at the beginning. While this show remains dedicated to our mission of mobilizing marketers to advance truth and civility in journalism, you need to have the tools to be able to have that impact. And showing positive business outcomes is table stakes. You can never promote values if you don't have a sound business model. So what we're trying to do is give you some of those tools so that you can be more effective in making the business case for the marketing that you're doing. And then you can really start to amplify those values. If you are a marketer and you're looking to balance your business objectives with your brand values, as we're trying to do here, and you need a team that can make your campaign successful through these methods, please reach out to our agency, Oxford Road, by visiting oxfordroad.com. Always subscribe to our weekly newsletter, The Influencer, which Kyle happens to be the editor-in-chief of. And special thanks to you, Kyle, to you, Giles, to Haley, to Bianca, to Jennifer, and the team at Podcast One. And as always, influence responsibly.